Welcome to Media and Culture, a podcast created for AEJMC's Cultural and Critical Studies Division. I'm Perry Parks, the division head for 2021-22, and I'm pleased to introduce this series that highlights timely and important research exploring cultural and critical topics in media studies.
Welcome. My name is Ruth DeFoster, and I served as the head of the Cultural and Critical Studies Division from 2020 to 2021. I'm delighted to welcome two longtime friends of the division, Ralph Beliveau and Erica Engstrom, to the podcast. Ralph Beliveau is an associate professor for the Gaylord College, an affiliate faculty in film and media studies and women's and gender studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes and teaches about media education and literacy, horror media, race, documentary, rhetorical criticism, video production, popular culture, and cultural studies. And some of his recent work includes Screening Me Too, Rape Culture in Hollywood, and book chapters on Shirley Jackson, Sin Eating, Stephen King, The Wire, and Supernatural. Welcome, Ralph. Erica Engstrom is a director of the School of Journalism and Media at the University of Kentucky. She's written books on bridal media and popular TV shows like Mad Men, NBC's Parks and Recreation, and the CW's Supernatural. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
So Erica and Ralph are the authors of the brand new book, Gramsci and Media Literacy, Critically Thinking About TV and the Movies. So thank you both for being here. And I just like to say, I was very excited to see this book come out. I teach these subjects to my students at the University of Minnesota in a big popular culture course. And I'm always looking for new readings for them to sort of help them understand these big complicated terms like hegemony. And it's just really nice to have this book because it brings those concepts and makes them a lot more palatable and kind of bite-sized for our undergraduate students, which I really appreciate. So I just want to open by asking, why did you decide to write a book in 2021 about the work of Antonio Gramsci, who worked, you know, he published his most famous work about 100 years ago. And why now? What does Gramsci's work offer students and scholars of the 21st century?
Well, I think that I would probably start by suggesting that although Gramsci's been a big influence on a lot of people in critical pedagogy, he's never really been put in the context of media literacy the way we were trying to, because of the amount of, you know, the amount that his theoretical work informs what we do in media literacy in terms of trying to get students and the general population actually to understand their interactions with the media, both in terms of what they do, you know, out of pleasure and what they do out of kind of a negotiation that's going on all the time about how reality is put together by the media they consume.
Yeah, Gramsci's ideas are relevant today, I think even more than ever. If you recall the last 4 years, we had a lot of misinformation. We had a lot of people who had access to media that don't necessarily, I think, do it for the right reasons. Gramsci saw the media as one portion of society that could actually educate, illuminate, and bring us closer to a just, equitable society. It could be used for good, and we often see it not used that way. So his vision for a society that I believe we as educators envision is one gender egalitarian, you know, sexuality egalitarian, economic egalitarianism. So today, I think it's even more relevant than ever. And then people don't question what media they're consuming, and they're not realizing what it's there for. So I think it's even more relevant today than it was in his time, because there's so much more of it. And it could be used for good.
I think there's also the idea that for a long period of time, I think the general idea in culture was that media was easy, right? That it was something that you didn't actually have to work very hard at. And I think those of us who were into popular culture as an area of study have, you know, and this goes back again, this probably goes back more than 100 years, have known that there's a lot to be offered in terms of taking it very seriously. But the culture was taking a long time to catch up. The recent, like Erica was mentioning, the recent past of how we're in this world of kind of like questionable facts and reality have just made it clear how overwhelmed we are by the media we're surrounded by. And so it's a bit of a cautionary tale in a way that if we don't smarten up about the way we make sense out of media, then it's just going to, you know, treat us in a way that Gramsci thought of, like, you know, the least capable people who are completely kind of crushed by the hegemony that they were under.
Yeah, I've always thought it was interesting how, and Gramsci was just way ahead of his time on this, like thinking about the mass media as this enormous ideological apparatus that we're all enmeshed in all the time. And that kind of leads me to this follow-up question. You know, Gramsci, he's writing in prison in the 1930s in, I mean, you know, this very scary fascist totalitarian dictatorship, in frankly, you know, this environment that in some ways does mirror some of the troubling turns that we're seeing toward authoritarianism and so forth, you know, in the West in the 21st century. So how can you think about Antonio Gramsci's work? How does his work inform your approach to specifically teaching media literacy today, and particularly in terms of education?
A lot of it has to do with our accepted common sense and our inability sometimes to think of alternatives to being. In my study of bridal media in the past, it's, of course, when we get married, we have to buy all this stuff. And why? Well, people tell us, and then we see it in all of these shows and magazines and movies. And so we just accept it and don't realize the actual good sense of what it means to spend $30,000, you know, to have this party that the media, you know, glamorizes. But a lot of these marriages, how many weddings have you gone to that the couple ends up in divorce, right? So a lot of people, I teach love and romance as well, and how we're inundated with these images and ideas about how relationships are supposed to go, and it's common sense. And then, you know, people don't have the tools to actually deal with true reality, you know, their everyday lives. So this idea of media literacy is so critical today, because where are people getting their information, right? And, you know, how are they even realizing who's credible, who actually is a news organization that's digging for facts, what's opinion? I mean, so there's a lot out there that people just accept as true for granted, instead of really critically thinking. And people don't have real time to do that. So we need to do that so we can educate not only media consumers, but media creators. And that's, you know, I hope that we instill in our students the good that media arts can do. Ralph?
I think, you know, part of it is also that whether people would like to admit it or acknowledge it or not, they're already, and this is where I think Gramsci was totally brilliant, was that we're already involved in a negotiation. You're already either allowing certain kinds of ideas to dominate your way of thinking about what weddings are, how things are supposed to look, the kind of repetition of these in kind of cultural practices and things like that, without even really interrogating what their meaning actually is, which is hard work, admittedly. But if you don't do it, then your side of the negotiation isn't very strong. You're just sort of going, okay. And media literacy is kind of premised on going, well, wait a minute, I've got to think about this. I've got to see, what does this actually mean to, you know, to what does it actually mean in the sense of the relationship between, say, the person getting married and the performance for family and everything else that is involved in that, the kind of the conspicuous consumption that is the foundation for a lot of that. And I just don't think people realize that they don't have a choice. They're already in the negotiation. And if they don't want to participate in it, that's fine. But then they just kind of, their voice isn't heard. And they don't even really understand the terms they're coming to accept as things tumble forward.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've really kind of been thinking about a lot when it comes to this question of how do we train up, you know, thoughtful, critical, media literate students in our classes is, you know, there are so many kind of barriers to that kind of education. And as you both mentioned, you know, a lot of times we don't have time. We're kind of enmeshed in this information environment. We accept uncritically the information that we're given. But one of the things that that I'm really concerned about for, with my own students is the landscape of algorithmic personalized information delivery. And so there are a lot of communication scholars recently who've warned that we're in the midst of this really significant epistemological crisis, you know, especially as audiences move away from these traditional professional journalistic sources for their news. I mean, it's not 1970, right? We're not watching the same three newscasts each night. If there's this incredible, you know, spread in terms of the places where we're getting our news, but for young folks and Gen Z in particular, they're relying increasingly on these algorithmic spaces on sites like Reddit or TikTok or Facebook or even Google, where they're only getting content that they already like and agree with. And with that in mind, I wonder if you could expound a little bit on some of the challenges that face educators who are seeking to teach this kind of media literacy in the 21st century.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to start by saying, one of the things historically that was really definitive was a time, and I think people mostly peg this in the 1980s, when the news operation of networks shifted from being, you know, basically a loss leader, right? They lost money and they were not supposed to make money. They were doing a public service that was much more important. And there was a shift, and some people argue, and I tend to like this argument, that it was the success of 60 Minutes that allowed people to start thinking of news divisions as profit centers. And as the corporatization of media kind of grew and grew, but what was lost in that is now, instead of the news being driven by the desire to, you know, present an accurate, reliable picture of the world that people can base their decisions on, they now have to make sure that that's also engaged with profit making, right? That it's engaged with trying to make sure that they're delivering the largest number of eyeballs to sell to advertisers. And that puts in place then a question, which is kind of what we're dealing with now, which is when you're looking at any one of these digital media sources, when you ask someone, where do you get your news from? And they say, well, Facebook or whatever, right? They're not any longer talking about an entity that has an ethical role. It's completely a commercial role. And so it will react algorithmically and in other ways, in whatever way it's going to be able to extract the most value out of the people who are paying attention to it. So I think that's the trick is coming to understand that the sources that seem to be making you happy don't have your best interests in mind. They have they want your attention as a product they can sell to other people, just like network television used to. They just learned how to monetize it in all sorts of different creepy ways.
Yeah, you can enjoy it. You can enjoy media, but just realize, oh, I'm on Facebook. I got this thing on my feed. I'll click on this shopping site, and all of a sudden I get all these other shopping sites. You can check them out, but that doesn't mean you have to open your wallet, stick your credit card number on there. Just to realize, you know, I know how much money it's, they want your money, right? Is that right? Right. They want your money somehow. So it's just realizing, yes, I realize what I'm doing here. I am in control here. I do not have to click on that button or whatever and go down the rabbit hole here. So I think it's empowering people to realize I'm in control here. I can turn this off. However, it's hard to teach your students. You can turn it off when they're walking around every day looking at their phone. And I'm like, what is so important that you're looking at it constantly? I just don't understand. Are they looking at their friends' posts? I've got to ask that to my students. What is going on there that this is so important that you're going to walk along and actually, I've seen students bump into, you know, signs and poles because they're looking at their phone. So we have to let students know you're in control. This is your life and that phone is not controlling you. How we can do that and get them to actually pay attention to a lecture, you know, for 45 minutes, that's one of the challenges.
Well, you know, one thing I would add to that, because I agree with that completely, but if you push the, you know, sort of individual responsibility thing a little bit further, you start ending up in what I kind of have been thinking more recently of as kind of a blame the victim situation. So yeah, we're responsible for, you know, we decide who we're going to follow on Twitter. We decide who we're going to follow on Instagram. And in that sense, we're culpable for whatever we're exposed to. But on the other hand, As a group, we're not, you know, it's not like we're interacting in an individual basis. What the algorithms and the structure of these things is attempting to do is to, again, turn us into something that can be monetized. And that's not an individual choice that people are making. That's kind of a collective interrelationship between the way the media are structured and the way that we're exposed to them. And so if they can, so in other words, it's like the 1-2 punch of saying, you know, we're going to give you more extreme content. Oh, and by the way, it's your fault you're getting more extreme content because you made the choices to put it on your feed, which isn't really true. I mean, it's kind of a lie, but that's been kind of the conversation that's been going on, is trying to pin responsibility on individuals based on their media behavior. And I think that there are, and one of the things, again, going back to Gramsci, there's this collective side to it that's really important to understand sort of the kind of folklore perspective in terms of what people bring when they're interacting with the media.
Yeah, this reminds me of this argument reminds me a little bit of that. There's an excellent book by Elaine Meehan called Why TV Is Not Your Fault. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And this is an argument that's 20 years old, that we sort of blame, you know, individual people or the will of the masses for demanding lowbrow or bad entertainment like reality TV, you know, these things that we sort of dismiss culturally as low culture. But the fact is, like, there is this invisible infrastructure of advertisers behind the scenes who really want that kind of product to be created because it's more profitable for the market that they're trying to reach. And so I definitely can see the point that, you know, the same thing could be said of social media, right? That what we want to do is make visible this invisible structure that's designed to monetize people's data and sort of helping students to understand that they are the product, that, you know, the thing that's being sold is them and their likes and their, you know, what they're clicking on and what they're choosing to engage with. And that can be empowering, like Erica said, understanding that you have that, you know, that the power to sort of shape what your algorithm is going to look like. But I think at the same time, at least I've seen with my students, I don't think they fully understand the degree to which their information environment is personalized and that it isn't sort of default or standard anymore. And that can be challenging, right? When you see, you know, students and audience members sort of uncritically replicating these hegemonic power structures and these norms, you know, especially in ways that are kind of invisible to them. They don't sort of understand how they're being manipulated. And so I wanted to build on that a little bit. For those who might not know, I'm sure most of our division members are familiar with Gramsci's work, but one of the most important concepts that came out of Gramsci's work, as you note in the book, is this idea of hegemony. So can you just expound a little bit on what that word means? And then how does popular culture in the U.S. uphold hegemonic norms?
All right, well, I'll give it a stab. Hegemony is basically a way to look at power structure. And if we look at media, who has the power in the media? Who's making these algorithms? And, you know, as media educators, we're also preparing students for careers in those same, right, entities. So hegemony is this idea that there is power, and we as the people without the power to create those media messages, we either consent by not resisting and saying no. And this implicit approval is when we consume, when we watch, when we click. And then it becomes a way that societal norms become normal, right? Because we see it from the people who have the power. So hegemony is this idea of the creation of this common sense, unquestioned acceptance of dominant ideology that is created by those in power. Is that basically it in a nutshell, Ralph?
Yeah, I think that, you know, an example of the kind of thing is there's a lot of struggle going on right now about teaching American history, for example. And this to me, it's a very much, you know, right in front of us struggle between ideas of an ideological notion of American history that is grounded on, you know, the sort of like the universal ethical goodness of American democracy. And all of these problems are seen as aberrations, right? Things that went wrong that can be fixed. Well, that's a little different from a story that starts maybe from the point of view that the whole structure was built on those differentiations to begin with. And so the struggle, hegemonically speaking, is going on over the negotiation that's going on is over how much of the actual history. And I think actual history has to include, you know, enslaved people and the genocidal activity toward Native Americans and things like that. You know, you can't sanitize that out. You no longer are dealing in history. You're dealing with a manufactured ideological representation of what American culture is. And, you know, what Gramsci suggests is that it really is it has to be a wide popular response that says, no, this is not a version of history that we can abide by because it's not accurate. It's not representative of what happened, of what the historical record says. And you can't just sanitize it like that by, you know, closing down events because the person who wrote the book, and you're having an event at the Alamo and the Texas government said, no, we're not going to do that because this person wrote too much about how a lot of the people in the Alamo were slaveholders. They were still slaveholders, regardless of whether you admit that or not. But it just becomes extremely important to be involved in that struggle to, you know, trying to make sure that how you're accounting for those sorts of things, you know, has the potential of reaching a level of justice that we'd all like to see.
There's a chapter in the book where we talk about, and Ralph took the lead on this, is how media portrays history. The Tulsa race massacre, how do I not know about this huge event? And how some media today are actually teaching history through popular media and through popular narratives, such as Watchmen. And so Ralph really looks at that side of hegemonic storytelling of this nation. And we need to question, is this really the true story? Why history is written by the victors, right? So what are the things that we're not being told by the people who are in power and have the access, means, and motive to, you know, tell us? Not it doesn't mean it's deliberately covering things up, but leaving things out that would threaten the hegemonic structure, the hegemonic power structure. And we're all familiar with that as cultural and critical scholars, that there is a structure in place that was created by certain people that favors certain people.
I think one of the, you know, we could have even put it in the title because it's such an important concept throughout the book, but the notion of counter-hegemonic representations or counter-hegemony, that alternative narratives can be offered and discussed and argued about. And what we, you know, what we do in the book is talk about these coming from places like the producers of Lovecraft Country, for example, or, you know, other historical representations that are attempting to try to correct that history, or it can be incorporated into very mainstream things, which is some of the work that Erica took the lead on, which talks specifically about the construction of gender identities in the Marvel universe. Because it's changed quite a bit. You know, there's been a lot of transformations of expectations of gender norms. And so as a result, when the conversation can turn that way, you can kind of look at them and say, why does this seem different? Why does this, you know, you don't just write it off as being kind of tokenism or something like that, but you see it as really fundamental to the way storytelling happens in a lot of places, not everywhere, of course, but in places where counter-hegemonic storytelling is taking place.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I appreciate that definition of hegemony because I do think it can be kind of a hard concept to teach, but it's interesting to think about the mass media landscape as Gramsci did, as a site of ideological contest, where, you know, we're always sort of either conforming to the hegemonic norm or pushing against it. And so that's why I thought the chapter that you just mentioned about hegemonic masculinity in particular, you actually did point to this. I really enjoyed this chapter in the book where you talk about the Disney franchise, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, MCU, and you talk about the MCU as really a key site of contest over mediated depictions of gender, of masculinity and femininity for contemporary audiences who are watching these shows and these films. Can you talk a little bit about some of the findings from that chapter some of the ways that masculinity and femininity are presented in perhaps hegemonic versus counter-hegemonic ways in the MCU?
Well, let's not say, you know, the MCU is overturning and a champion for, you know, alternative gender identity for LGBTQ. But it does incorporate little bits, and that's what counter-hegemony is. It's not this total overthrow, but it's bit by bit, adding a little here and a little there, right? Although Gramsci's whole vision was to transform society. But the MCU, once I saw, you know, these movies, you know, a lot of us are familiar with these movies, but I was really struck by Endgame. And to me, as I'm not a MCU big time fan, I don't have the comics, I'm familiar with it, but when I saw Avengers Endgame, I thought that was, you know, we don't need all the other movies. This Endgame is the Endgame. And so we saw, you know, men on screen, these superheroes actually showing weakness, showing vulnerability. This is very, to me, unusual in the history of Hollywood. There's always been great movies with counter-hegemonic masculine portrayals. But, you know, growing up on John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, Stallone, Schwarzenegger, it's always this one-sided view of men, right? And so the hegemonic masculinity that we've come to accept is men are supposed to be this, 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 and that. They're supposed to be opposite to women. So in Endgame, we see a lot of that opposite to women actually being portrayed. We see Captain America, right, who actually goes for help in a support group, which is an advocation for mental health. Men aren't supposed to ask for help, right? Men are supposed to be tough. We see Thor crying. We see actual superheroes crying. And I found that very, very, I think, hopeful. It's not to say it's the greatest champion for counter-hegemonic or, you know, reflection of real life where men are more than what we see on screen. But especially in terms of masculinity, I thought that it offers a palatable way of looking at the little, you know, incursions into hegemonic masculinity. So in that chapter, I was looking at, you know, how can we have a more complete, balanced portrayal of what we call, you know, masculinity today? And I think there is a little bit of progress. It's not overturned. Last 4 years, who was the, you know, quote, man in charge of this country was complete hegemonic masculinity without any of that more balanced side. And I don't think I'm being political here. I'm being, I think, factual. What kind of quote man was being, you know, performance of man was being portrayed, and there was a lot of concern and worry about appearing strong rather than a more balanced way of how humans can be. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question about that?
Yeah, definitely. I just think it's an interesting case study because, you know, I do think that this is why this book is important, is because, you know, these ideas from the 1930s, they can feel really far off to students who are studying in the 21st century, who inhabit this really different media landscape than Gramsci ever knew. But the concepts are still highly relevant to the media landscape that we inhabit today. I mean, we still see that we have to unpack political economy. We have to see, you know, we have to consider things like cross promotion and risk. I mean, when we're thinking about an analysis of a huge multinational media conglomerate like Disney, it's really interesting to take that from the perspective of Gramsci, because he asks us to not just consider the ways in which, you know, a product like Disney is helping to uphold hegemonic norms, but also those small, like you said, like those places where you mentioned this in the book, you say hegemony is always leaking. I can't remember who that's a quote from, but the idea that there are these little bits that are always sort of leaking, and these moments where you can really see these challenges to the status quo. And then you can also, from a, you know, cultural studies and Gramscian standpoint, consider what the rationale is behind that. There's always this kind of chicken and egg question when we're considering progressive representations like in MCU. The question is, you know, is this a response to audience demand? Is this just a recognition that, you know, Gen Z and younger millennial audiences have become more progressive on issues of gender and sexuality? So I think that's why it is a really interesting case study. Anything else you'd like to add about MCU and that chapter where we're looking at sort of gender and hegemonic versus counter-hegemonic representations?
Well, I was just going to add, I think one... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to attribute the leaking to Linda Steiner, feminist critical scholar.
That's right. Thank you.
Yeah. So it's not like hegemony is this all domineering, complete domination of us, and we're just, you know, victim sheep, but there's always going to be people who see another way. And so that's the leaking. There's always going to be people pushing back. And the MCU is learning, I think, that having alternatives to what we've typically seen does make money. I mean, this was the biggest box office success in the history of Hollywood. We had some of these counter hegemonic things in there. So, you know, hey, we can make money by showing more balanced and different ways of being. The portrayal of women, however, in the MCU, I think still needs a lot of work. So, we get progress in one area, still not. So it's an ongoing, it's dialectical, right? It keeps going around in a circle. So, go ahead, Ralph.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and that kind of emphasizes the point that hegemony is a process. It's not a thing, right? It's a process that is a struggle. And I think struggle is a really good way to think about it. One of the things that I think is interesting in the book is this tension between the naturalism or realism of representations versus the sort of fantasies that are connected to it through our media consumption. I think as Americans, we're really bad at talking about pleasure. Pleasure is a very complicated thing, and we just decide not to talk about it. I think it makes some people nervous to talk about it. But pleasure is an issue that's kind of set aside. Something can be pleasurable and be like really politically problematic at the same time. And that can be an important way to kind of understand what you're looking at. But then inside of it, and this might be one of the more complicated things to try to communicate with students, is the representation. The idea that the representation is threading a line between like a projected idea of what something is and the reality of what something is, and how they incorporate that into their own ways of thinking about how the world works, how they're thinking about, you know, things like, you know, consent in a sexual situation, or how they act in terms of, you know, just and fair treatment for people who are experiencing difference of different kinds. Those are naturalistic things, but they are reflected in these fantasy texts that we consume for lots of different pleasure reasons. So,
To me, it becomes even more pleasurable when we see these alternatives. It just makes it even more fun. Am I right? Oh wow, this is fantastic! I'm enjoying it, and plus, they're actually doing something positive. So, you know, you can make money and, you know, forward justice in a real sense, especially for younger people.
Right. I think the trick as teachers is, of course, trying to make sure that people are able to understand the machinery of the industries and how they make things possible or impossible, you know, depending on what's happening in an industry at any particular historical point. So is it going, you know, are we still, I'm always interested because I'm also not the biggest fan in the world of superhero films. And every time I think that they're possibly have played out and we're going to be shifting our cultural attention somewhere else, then my students today are talking about staying up until 3 a.m. to buy Spider-Man tickets. And I just think, oh, okay, I guess this is still a thing, you know?
Yeah, we've all lived through probably a dozen iterations of Spider-Man at this point, film and TV and comic books. But I do think this is a really good argument, I mean, for the existence of cultural studies as a discipline. And frankly, I'm sure this is something that all of us have faced, you know, when we're having conversations sometimes. I mean, I have this within my own family because my mother is a biochemist, right? And these conversations about like different kinds of science and why social science is really important. And to your point here, I think, you know, this is why social science and critical and cultural studies is so important, because, you know, it is escapism, it is fantasy, it is fiction, right? But it is also this place of ideological contest. And it is this place where our students are learning who they are and how to relate to the opposite sex or to each other, and how to, you know, be in society, how to treat people who they perceive as different from themselves, how to perform their gender, right? And so I think that's a real argument for why we should be talking about, you know, MCU as a serious object of academic study. And so I'm grateful that you did that in this book. So finally, before we wrap up, I did want to ask, what are the key takeaways you'd like to highlight for educators who are listening to this podcast? So what are some things we can teach our students in order for them to become more knowledgeable, critical, and discerning consumers of pop culture?
Well, if I can jump in, I give them the terms for concepts that they already observe so that they can recognize and detect what they're seeing, right? The more you know, the more you see, which is an axiom of critical scholar David Matherius. When I know what hegemony is, when I know what certain, you know, concepts are that we teach them and they can detect them right through their consumption, not only does it make it more pleasurable in that they're knowing what they're seeing, but they can also, I hope, tell their friends about it while they're watching, you know, did you see what happened right there? You know, that's this concept, and they're really doing a good job showing that, and we need more of that. So it's a lot of it is the enjoyment of detecting what we know. Does that make sense? Because it makes it even more enjoyable, I think, and maybe making learning more enjoyable, because you can enjoy the media that you're consuming as long as you're looking at through a critical lens and maybe thinking about if you were to be a media producer, how you could improve.
I think that points at like having a, for lack of a better term, kind of a toolkit of good questions to bring. And so one of the ones I was just talking to a class earlier today, you know, I haven't done anything in this direction yet, but I'm really interested in seeing what kind of scholarship develops around Squid Games, because it was this enormous cultural phenomenon. And I said to my class, you know, the question is why? Why at this point in history did that take off the way that it did in American culture? And I said to them, there might be a number of answers. That's one of the things that people in cultural studies discovered early on, or at least emphasized early on, was the notion of polysemy, that these texts speak in multiple ways to multiple audiences, partially connected to who you are and the context you're seeing it in. And so there might be multiple answers to that question. But, you know, why did superhero films become as popular and as important as they did when they did? Why is it continuing? What will eventually happen when it stops? And like the traditional dominance of Westerns, it kind of like fade away. What makes people often say that, you know, musicals came at a point when people really desired this really enormous, elaborate fantasy. And then it went away when people were trying to be very, you know, kind of hardcore. In the 70s and 80s, and the idea of musicals was a little bit too fantastic for them. You know, that was one possible explanation. I think there were others, but I'm always interested when things change in the media. There might be technological reasons that changes are happening, economic reasons, there might be aesthetic reasons, but that's always a really good question to have right in the toolbox. Why is this happening?
Yeah, and just providing the students with the vocabulary to be able to, like Erica said, just in a sophisticated way, be able to actually parse the nuances of, you know, not just what they're seeing, but why it was delivered to them. So yeah. Great. Well, thank you both so much for making the time to chat today. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
You have been listening to Media and Culture, a podcast created for AEJMC's Cultural and Critical Studies Division. I'm Perry Parks, the division head for 2021-22. Please look for future editions in this series and check us out on social media.